Welcome to episode 34 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast.
And we're recording on April 25th, 2016.
So we're late again. How late are we this time?
We're I don't know.
Oh my gosh. Oh, no, it's not too bad. It's 4 days.
Four days. Yeah. I thought it was worse.
We've just been barely holding on. We have so much going on.
Oh, dear.
So this is going to be a short one.
It will be.
Right? Mm-hmm. Or, I don't know, we have lots of stuff. We have so much stuff we're doing. Mm-hmm. So we've had to cut back a bit on our studying, and I think I only have two articles.
I do too.
Okay. But we have a lot to talk about.
Right.
Stuff we've been doing, so. Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to try to put an order to this. So, go ahead. What do you want to do?
How about we start with some science stuff?
Okay.
Okay. So, I read this article.
I have three articles.
Nice. Okay. I read this article in Science. And that's been recently published. Refugee crisis brings new health challenge. And I read it, and, you know, there are some things I expected, like a rise in TB and things like that. What I didn't expect is in the article they talk about, and this is the refugee our migrant movement in Europe specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I expected TB, but they said that the rate of increase isn't as great as what they expected, and that the transmission among non-migrant people, it doesn't seem to be changing that much.
Hmm.
And this is like kind of an initial, you know, study.
And this is a study across all of Europe?
Yeah.
So we're talking about not mixing, but hitting on the migrants coming up through the Mediterranean, and then you have the whole Syrian crisis.
Right, right,
and then
exactly.
You have Eastern European migrants going west to a certain extent.
So when I read the article, there are some things that, you know, I was just like, oh, you know, there'd just be this influx of disease. Yes. And they said, yeah, they're going to be, doctors in Europe are going to have to be more aware of non-European diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So things that seemed uncommon or unheard of before,
they're
going to have to start to realize, oh, we have a migrant community. These are the possibilities with this kind of condition.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, oh, well, that makes sense.
What are some of the diseases?
Parasites,
okay,
specifically.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to, that was further down. Okay, I'll come back to that because there's a section where I'll get into. But before I do, oh, okay, here we go. An intestinal tapeworm, liver abscess caused by amoebae. So there's like parasitic parasites that they're carrying that just are very uncommon to the European community.
All the type of stuff that's usually controlled by public health.
Right.
Like not so much the health system, but public works.
Exactly.
Potable water.
Right, right. And
treatment of sewage, blah, blah, blah.
So, so they said their biggest challenge is how to ensure that refugees don't get sick once they arrive.
Mm-hmm.
Because the refugees are coming used to their own, you know, community and the diseases, their bodies are used to the diseases that are present there. And so some of it, you know, is a challenge of trying to make sure that they have good conditions. So there's a lot of overcrowding in the houses
mm-hmm.
or in the housing that they have, unsanitary conditions. Sometimes water supply is short, and those conditions have really spread, like hepatitis, cholera, typhoid fever. So that's something that's kind of new in the upswing, okay? Now, here's something interesting I thought, is that there was an outbreak in Calais, France, of 13
Remember
people.
Remember, we talked about that.
Yeah, I thought we had.
So I know a bit about this.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is really a weird situation. There's this in huge, like, it's like, when you call the Depression area, Depression era, places where people used to live outside of cities, Hoovervilles.
Yeah.
It's like there's a Hooverville outside of Calais,
mm-hmm.
right? And these are all migrants that they've entered Europe, as far as I know, legally, and so mm-hmm. that's not a problem. And they want to go to England. And either they've been offered a job by someone there, or they mm-hmm. know of a job that they're suited for, or they have family that's already in England. And the English are like, no, we're not going to take this many people. And the French are saying, well, we're not going to let them go because that's not fair. You can't just let them just cross, you know, there's freedom across the European nation borders, mm-hmm. but France is like, England doesn't want them. If we let them cross, this is going to be a nightmare. So they're keeping them there and kind of trying to do the best they can for them. But,
right.
you know, no one wants to spend money on these people. So the conditions there may be better than if they ended up in England, but they're not good there. And then the people from Calais, their local residents, are just fed up with all these people outside and everything. So, yeah, the last I heard, they were sending bulldozers in.
Right.
And they were going to move people to, like, hotels and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the solution, you know?
Right.
I mean...
Right.
Yeah. I don't know what's
going on. And, you know, that's probably to control cholera, typhoid, all those things
yeah.
when you
so
don't
those
have...
13 cases, there were
okay.
four...
Okay, so 13 cases, I didn't get to finish, but the
yeah.
13 cases were for measles.
Measles,
but
okay.
here's the thing, they were like, wow, you know, those measles were brought in here. But actually, what happened was the immigrants, or the migrants,
yeah.
got the measles that's a measle type from
Calais.
From Spain, actually.
Oh, from Spain,
and
okay.
it was volunteer workers going there and transmit it to them.
And that sounds like a familiar, where volunteers actually
yeah.
transmit diseases.
So
to,
the
yeah.
volunteers are transmitting diseases, not knowingly.
No,
they're,
of course. Yeah.
They're carrying their local,
yeah.
you know, flora and fauna of their region.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I read the article, I hadn't really thought of the migrants
yeah.
having to deal with all these new things.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of all the things they were bringing in. So far, it's more of a case with numbers, population, squeezed together.
Right.
And then hit with new viruses and weakened, you know,
right.
immunities. So, anyway, it was just one of those things that, as I read through, I was like, wow. So, and it even said, the virus genotype matched strains circulating in Spain and United Kingdom, suggesting that a volunteer working in the camp touched,
yeah.
you know, tort or touch of the outbreak. So, anyway, I thought it was
yeah.
just an interesting...
It's neat that Calais came up because
yeah.
we've kind of had that on our radar.
Right.
Or we had it on our radar a little while ago. And
right.
I don't know what's been happening. You know, I haven't looked since then, but...
Yeah. So, and, you know, not a very different situation, but similar problem.
Uh-huh.
In Japan right now, after the two earthquakes, the 6.2 and then the the second shock of a 7 struck Kyushu Island, 28 hours apart.
Which one is... That's in the south, isn't it?
Yeah.
Kyushu.
44 people died, and totally or partially destroying more than 2,000 buildings. And it said more than 200,000 people are homeless. So, it's just amazing to me how, you know, how they're going to deal with that kind of sudden refugee, you know, that they have to find places for. So, anyway, I'm looking forward to getting more information about the earthquake, and I think there will be some in later issues. But anyway, just a very short mention of it since they had similar situations. Okay. Now one from you.
Sure. I have stuff on balloon data, which is, let me see if I have something that matches with your stuff. I think the balloon data is the best one. So I guess every day, let me see, they had the statistics here. 800 weather, okay, there's 800 weather balloon stations around the world.
Okay.
I don't know if those are fixed or not, because I know ships also send off weather balloons. And that's really, they didn't go into this in depth, but that's a really critical part of the whole weather modeling and forecasting system. Because, you know, we're mostly ocean, and there's no balloon stations in the ocean, of course, so if you don't have the ships sending them off. But anyway, I don't see anymore how many are sent up every day, but it's just an amazing amount. And basically, these balloons, they are filled with either hydrogen or helium. They're released. They have instrumentation on board that measures stuff. And they go up 30 kilometers, and then they pop, and a parachute brings down the stuff.
I got to release one with a group of teachers and a meteorologist.
Cool.
Yep.
Remember we saw, like, there was a maker fair, was it in Burlington?
And they used balloons for images.
Yeah.
High altitude images, which they've gotten some cool shots of the Earth.
Do you remember Jerry Boyd?
Yeah.
Who's one of the guys from the ARDF who'd sent us some images from balloon work he'd done. Sorry, I'm just getting warm. I gotta take this off. Anyway, and we had it at our on our computer screen for the longest time. That was
it was
cool.
An incredible picture.
Anyway, so they go out, they collect all this data, and the big point of the data is twofold. One is, well, it has a lot to do with the satellite data. A lot of the forecasting is done with the satellite data. But how do you know what physical quantities these satellites are measuring? Because it's all remote. Well, that's what the balloons tell you, right? So you can see in a certain infrared image, you got a balloon there going up telling you what the temperature is, what the wind is.
Oh, got it. So and they're calibrating.
So they're calibrating the satellite data and also supplementing it. There's other things that the weather balloons measure that there's no way to get from the satellite. So it's all really important. Okay, so we're going to have to deal with funky acronyms here. The original format for the data that's being given by these balloons is called TEMP, T-E-M-P. Okay. They call it in the article an alphanumeric format. I'm going to get back to that. But basically, it's text, right?
Right.
That's what it means. Right. Goes back to 1946. So there's, let me see, there's a world organization for I can't find it anywhere. It's the World Meteorological Organization, of course. So in 1988, they said, this temp data, you know, we've gone way past that. We got to change our whole system, right? And some of the reasons they give for that is that the temperature, for example, it's reported in degrees C, mm-hmm. but it's the closest point to degrees C. That's right. One example. Another one is the atmosphere. It doesn't give you the altitude. It divides it up into 100 levels, mm-hmm. and it just gives you the what level it's at. And at the higher levels, it's like within 10 meters close enough.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see it's very rough data, right? Mm-hmm. And it steps. And the whole temp structure, the data structure, is a fixed format. I think they don't explain what that means, but I think what it is, it's actually number of spaces, ASCII spaces.
Got it.
Because I've seen this type of stuff in the system used to do antenna modeling, where you have some mm-hmm. programs that accept this particular data and nothing else. And mm-hmm. we've gone so much beyond that in terms of the interfaces and what we can do with it. But the raw data going in is still the same because the program is basically the same as it was in the 1970s.
Got it. You know?
Okay. So WMO said, okay, we've got to change this. And in 1988, they said, we've got a new code, it's going to be binary. Well, okay, so we understand that. It's going to be able to hold a lot more information, be much more versatile, and we're going to call it buffer, B-U-F-R. Okay, well, I think people love these names so much, but anyway.
Temp to buffer.
Anyway, so it became a new international standard along with the temp.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, in 2003, they said, okay, everybody has to switch from temp to buffer by November 2014. And damn it, everybody must switch, okay? So everybody switch, and no one did anything. Or, well, that's not true. But a lot of places didn't do anything for the longest time. It looks like, so if you, oh, I didn't say where this was from. So this is from Science, April 15th, mm-hmm. and it's on page 281. Anyway, there's a great map on page 282. So it shows the world, and it has a little dot or a triangle that marks every spot on Earth that's got one of those radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
And they're color-coded.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, all the red that you're looking at is the old buffer system. And then the blue is... The red is the temp system, the old system, right? And then the blue is the new one. So you can see Europe
is... It was along the coast of North Carolina, right? And
It's all the old system around North Carolina.
Yeah, There's no blue.
Basically, the United States has just got nothing.
Right.
You know, Mexico's doing really well.
Yeah.
Canada in the south is doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And Europe is doing fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, Australia is doing awesome.
Oh, yeah. They're only blue.
Yeah. So,
and same with New Zealand.
New Zealand's all the red.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Sorry, I thought it was blue.
And basically, there's two types of the new system, the buffer. The light blue is a low resolution system, and mm-hmm. the dark blue is a high resolution. England, by the way, is not looking too good, but all the rest of Europe, especially through, well, Spain and... the Germanic and Scandinavian type countries
mm-hmm.
have all the high resolution stuff. And Australia, all the high resolution. Okay, so the old temp system, that's red, but it's either light red or kind of dark brown.
Mm-hmm.
You can see North Canada is all still the dark brown. Basically, the problem is you have to change all the equipment at the weather station. So it's a big expense. That's why in the South, you see Canada's tried to change for everything, but stuff that's remote, they have to cart things out there. And
got it.
So it's not just a software issue, right? Because the hardware needs to be able to make these different measurements. Okay, so now, I've got to say it, Kelly, saying it about all sorts of things, but I got to say it's stupid as hell. It's the light red, okay? Do you know what the light red is?
No.
Well, it's buffer.
Oh.
But what it is they're still sending out balloons that have the temp hardware. They're measuring temp data, right? They're bringing it back down, and then they just wrote a piece of software that converts it to buffer and said, see, we converted. But it's still temp data. There's no buffer data in there, right? All the high-resolution stuff, or even low-resolution
buffer. That's all over the buffer. United States.
Yeah! So United States, basically, India and China. Stupid as hell. And it looks like a lot of South America. They didn't talk about South America. But yeah, that's just... Anyway, it's not going to change that way. U.S. has some plans... to change.
Well, they're supposed to be setting up like a system for monitoring in cities that's supposed to be new and huge for
but those are ground ones. They're not
balloons.
Yeah,
they're
that's a different issue. Yeah. So the NOAA said let's see, buffer data and its models by the end of 2016. Well, that's in its models. Okay, so that's a different issue even. Let's not even go there yet. so we got this, the weather balloons first, and the weather stations that send the balloons up have to be brought up to speed. One of the big issues is that this data is being used by weather stations and forecasters, and also by modelers. Well, 2014 has come and gone. What that means is that temp is no longer one of the two standards. It's gone. Well, you know, it's an expense maintaining two systems. So I can't remember. I think Spain just suddenly went off the air. They're like, we're not putting out temp. A whole bunch of ships that cross the Atlantic that are European ships, they're like, hey, satellite transmission from our ships, that's an expense. They shut off temp data. Now that's really serious, because that's a huge swath that's now has nothing.
Right.
And so if you're trying to do some weather forecasting, suddenly that's gone. If you're, so that's a different system that has to change. All the software and the models you do to do your forecasting have to be rewritten to handle buffer data.
Right.
Right. And I love, there's this one guy, I don't know how he got into this, but, and I can't find it looking at the site now, but he basically set up this website, and he was getting temp data directly from the World Organization for Meteorology. And he couldn't, it was funny, and the article says, and he just gets it from them and converts it to text. I'm like, it is text, that's the point, but anyway. And then people that do research started to get requests from his site. So I guess all he's doing is reformatting it so it's easier to use. Well, these people don't know nothing about temp versus buffer, right? They just found his site, started to use it. He gets, on a slow day, if I'm remembering correctly, 130,000 requests.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know what it is? It's people at universities that are doing weather studies write a program. And then the program queries, so it's not people clicking there 130,000 times.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, that's heavy burden on the site.
That's good.
Well, he's getting calls and emails like saying, hey, where's the data gone from Spain? And he's like, it's not my fault, right? He just set up the website, collect the data. So suddenly he was doing this. It was kind of working automatically. Now he's going to have to put in a huge expense because people are getting angry with him because the data is not there. So now he has to change his software so that it'll handle buffer.
Oh,
right?
Dear.
But you can see what's going to happen.
Yeah.
People are then going to call up and say, yeah, your data's not, I can't read it. So everybody's going to, you know, the future's here.
Yeah.
People are just going to have to deal.
Yeah. Oh, that's too funny.
So, yeah, I love this article because it's...
Yeah. Stuff
that's still with us from the only thing is they keep talking about how obsolete the text data is, and it's not, right? It's the data is the system for the data might be obsolete, but the concept that it's obsolete because it's text is incorrect. There's a lot of value to having text. I don't, you know, it seems like I bet you the buffer data has some text parts to it that are easy to handle without any like you might need the decoding of the binary to get to the text parts, but there's a lot that's handy about text.
Neat.
Anyway, so I thought that was good.
It is.
I want to hit on one other super quick because it's kind of, it's not exactly related, but it's one of those data things.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the Dutch are taking or have taken the presidency of the European Union for, I don't know how long, 6 months, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It switches from one place to the other. And so when you've got the presidency, then your country can, you know, push stuff because it handles the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got this huge push for making science articles open access.
Oh, good for them.
Yeah, and the reason I thought that was interesting is because I heard from the Linux Voice people that there was a big computer thing where the Dutch government was pushing for open source type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, wow, this is really...
That's really
the
neat.
Country, the whole country must have this philosophy.
Nice.
The only thing I'm going to mention is that because this might come back to us in the future... There's like two ways for open access science to be viewed. They call it the gold open access and the green open access.
Mm-hmm.
And the gold open access system would be basically, so you do some research and then you send your article to
a publisher
and then you pay them to make it open access.
Got it.
And the green open access is basically you take your paper, you put it on a public site, and you send it to the publisher. And there's good and bad points about both. I found it interesting, even though the gold you pay the publisher, some people analyze this and say, from the publisher's point of view, this is not a winning situation. And... my guess is that if everybody pays, they're still going to be able to make less than if they can charge a premium from institutions. I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder what that's going to do. You know what I mean? I just can't.
Yeah. And then the green, there's some people that are worried about because if you put a preprint of your paper on and that's what ends up there, well, it doesn't have a lot of the really good edits. That it needs.
That's why I was thinking you're going to have two different texts.
That
it can be damaging.
Yeah.
Depending on, you know, how the edits are. Or how it is edited before it hits.
This, by the way, is from also Science, April 15th, and page 279. There was one other issue with the green that... It's not as simple as you just put your paper out there, because a lot of the publishers are saying basically, no, if you want to publish here and you want to put it on your own, on some other server or something, that's fine, but you have to wait an embargo period.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that makes it that basically people don't look at it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
because it's not during the critical part where it becomes part of the new information that's available. It's, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Neat.
Anyway.
Nice.
That's all the data type stuff.
I have another bio one.
Okay.
And this one is the tiniest titan. And it's talking about the Titanosaurus.
Uh-huh.
And this woman.
This is a baby?
Christina, yeah, Curry Rogers.
I heard about this.
Yeah, so in 2012, this article was just published in April 22nd. 2016. But in 2012, this paleontologist, Christina Curry Rogers, was digging through this drawer of miscellaneous crocodile fossils, which it must have been, you know, when I read that, it brought back the memories of ornithology drawers.
Yes, yes.
Where you open these ornithology drawers and you hope that everything was well preserved, and the odd time you'd have to pitch something that smelled. It was kind of crazy. But anyway, so I was thinking
of
these.
Would be only bones? Would that be right?
Only bones, okay. Yeah. So they're bones. And then when she was looking through it, she noticed that there was something familiar about this, this bone structure, and it reminded her of a giant dinosaur, but in miniature.
Before we go back to that,
yeah,
did you see the significance of why crocodile fossils? Because I found out some stuff about that.
So, because it's the hatching line, there is a shift in the internal structure of the bone.
Uh-huh.
That in modern lizards and crocodiles.
Yeah, but so what I'm getting at is that the reason there's these collections of crocodile fossils is that at that time, and I don't know how long ago it was, but there was this humongous diversification in crocodiles.
Right.
And supposedly they had some that were carnivorous, some that ate plants, some that swam, some that ran. Like, they could run as fast as a rabbit. Others were big. Others were tiny.
Yeah.
So there's, like, practically every form in the croc. Yeah.
So that makes sense.
Which is why they have these giant collections.
I didn't realize that, so I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Oh, and...
And it also explains why you might have bones in there that you don't... They're totally misclassified.
Right.
Because since you can have practically anything being a crocodile.
Any mystery,
yeah,
you put it in
it's
there.
It's like you put it in with the crocodiles. So, a new type.
Huh? Yeah. So I thought you were getting to, like, kind of the way the eggs form and that. Anyway, cool thing about it, after doing the studies on the bones and that, they found that between day 39 and 77 days, of life, that it changed in magnitude from 3.4 kilograms to 40 kilograms.
Okay, well, so let's, wait a second. Let's say 40 to 77, that's 20
in a little over a month.
Days. So it's about a month. It's basically gone up 35 kilos.
Ten times. It is 10
times. Oh, yeah,
times
more than that
weight.
Even.
Yeah. So when I started looking at that, I'm like, wow, it was changing. You know, you could see this guy change from day to day.
There must have been nothing left alive after.
I know.
Around. So, it's a titanosaur?
Yeah.
So this is a...
So this is...
This is not a carnivorous animal then.
No.
Right. Dinosaurs looked a little bit like the Diplodocus and those types.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
In very, very broad terms.
Yeah.
Me not
Isn't
knowing
that
dinosaurs.
Cool. So anyway. So, and what did they say? So what it gives clues that, that these, Titanosaurs they're young, mm-hmm. were pretty independent. They don't know for sure, but it indicates that these were probably fairly independent young.
So there's something else that indicates that. Because I heard about this. Did you come across the proportions in the bones?
Yeah. So the weight bearing, it shows that they've had weight bearing in their bones, and that indicated that they were walking and feeding themselves.
Okay, I did not know that, actually.
Okay.
No, what I came across was that, let me try to remember. Okay, so you know, our kids, when they're babies, they've got these huge heads, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then as they grow, the rest of the body grows faster than the head. So the proportion from, like, skull versus other types of, they change.
Right.
Right? But that's not the case with all animals.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, the bone proportions, as they grow, the proportions stay absolutely the same.
Right.
So if that's the case, the baby looks like a very small version of the adult.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, the Titanosaurus, this is it's a baby,
mm-hmm.
and it looks exactly
right
like the adult.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that across the board, generally, I don't know if it's an absolute rule, but from the animals we know, for which we know the life history, the ones that have bones that have the same proportion when they're babies as adults, also ones that basically can are independent of their parents very early on.
So the tiny dinosaur was constantly keeping its bones the right shape as it grew, evidence that they had undergone the biomechanical stress of walking around. That goes along with what you were saying.
Oh, yeah, and man, where did I?
I think you heard it.
I think I heard it
podcast,
on another podcast.
I
heard an interview with.
I think you heard the science podcast.
Yeah, I think I heard an interview with the researcher.
Yeah, probably.
And
it sounds just like such a fascinating story.
So, I think she was. I don't know why she was looking through the crocodile bones, but she was an expert, I think, on the mm-hmm. Titanosaurus.
Mm-hmm.
And she was going through, and she looked at a bone, and she'd be like, well, I recognize this. She'd go through, and then, I recognize this. That's Titanosaur. That's not, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because she'd studied the adult. No one knew yet
mm-hmm.
that these grow with constant proportion,
right?
So she's finding these tiny little bones and recognizing them from having studied the adults. And so she started to collect. She started to go through the rooms. She collected all of these. That she's like, these look like tiny little titanosaur bones. So she collects them all. And two things happen. Mm-hmm. One, there's no two of the same bone.
Oh, wow.
So in other words, you might have two femurs, but one's a right femur and one's a left.
Oh, nice.
You never have two right paws or whatever, right? And they go back through the records, and they found that all of that part of the collection, it wasn't collected all at the same time, but it was collected all from the kind of the same area, close to the same time.
Oh, that
so
was
they
so
think
lucky.
That people were just collecting bones in this area, bringing them over, mm-hmm. and
they would chuck them in the drawer.
Chuck them in the drawer, and they were all from. And they think it's one baby.
Yeah, that's what it said. And that is so funny to hear the whole story come out. So we have this one individual, but to think of these bones randomly chucked in a, crocodile drawer or a reptile drawer. That's
anyway,
fun.
It's a neat story.
Yeah, very nice. So, and how about... well, we could go to our blogs or what we've been doing recently.
Because
your
getting...
blog kind of goes along with that.
Yeah.
I've finished my articles. I
think I'm
going to
close the rest of mine.
Far.
There's some really neat single atom ones
neat.
In science. But so if people are interested, April 15th one, especially the single atom heat engine.
Mm-hmm.
But I am going to close it because, okay, like, we started this late and I am getting tired. I mean, we've been running around.
We have been.
So crazy.
So, yep.
So, what did we do, or blogs?
Or
all, it's kind of all the same.
Mm-hmm. Mine's a little different.
Yours is the same. Yours is different, except that it's more you doing even more stuff also, because this is makerspace stuff, right?
No, it's what
it's
we
the
just
drone
did.
Project.
No.
No?
No, that was last time. This is biotechnology. We got a grant to create...
I didn't see that blog entry yet.
Transformed
Okay.
Bacteria.
That's the one you just emailed to me? Sorry,
yeah,
I just haven't had a look at it.
No worries. So basically, I'll show you some pictures.
Oh, when you showed me the picture.
Yeah. So yeah. I put the picture on my phone. So the students had an opportunity to do E. coli lab, where they transformed E. coli into GFP E. coli. And so they learned all the steps, mm-hmm, and they were able to go through the process, and it was really exciting. And we had 275 eighth graders participate in the lab. In fact, I was setting up for the lab tonight. That's why I was late. Mm-hmm. I was helping another class of eighth graders get going, three more classes, to do the same project. You know, this is a huge lab that is usually done in AP biology classes.
Uh-huh.
But most of our students don't get there. You know, that's the few students that are going on into biology that may take those classes. So this was a nice way for the students to really have a hands-on experience and to really start to think about what biotechnology is, you know, where... If something is bioengineered, they're just taking foreign DNA and they're putting it, mm-hmm, into the plant or the animal. And the students having that insight, I hope it will give them the foundation for making good choices about their food and, mm-hmm, you know, and regulations about the things. So
at least get them comfortable with the whole technology.
Right.
So
it's
they can
just
find out more in the future.
And they'll go and research on their own, but it won't be something that, you know,
that's totally alien
and somehow they're making choices out of fear instead of really seeing what's happening.
Yeah.
So, and I have a few pictures of the students doing it. The students were very serious. I mean,
I was about to say,
for the
they
last
like
to, like, you know, when they were doing the lab for those 2 or 3 days, I have to say I kind of stressed and lost some sleep before the lab started.
Yeah.
And but when it was running, I didn't have to raise my voice or anything. They understood why we were doing it. They understood why it was important to do each step. And they were being the teachers. They were monitoring each other.
Cool.
And they would be like, think of the sterile environment. You aren't to open that package until you get over, you know.
Yeah.
So it was really nice to see them being that serious,
cool,
and that proactive about it. So that's my blog.
I can't wait to read it.
Yep.
So, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I did get your, I don't know. Did we talk about our last two blogs last time? We didn't about mine, but we did about yours.
Yeah.
You talked about NASA engineers compared to your
mm-hmm,
drone project.
Mm-hmm.
Mine was so late and so short, but I got it up there. And it's just about the whole idea that we should... We're blogging about stuff we study and stuff we do.
Mm-hmm.
And that should always come first.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it gets to be smaller, then that's fine. And mm-hmm, I wrote a tiny little one, this was the first time it hit me that, man, we are accomplishing so much.
Mm-hmm.
And then the one that you just talked about, which is not up yet, and mine that's not up yet, but also written, I don't want to say my next one is lamenting that all building has stopped, but it was just saying, you know, all the plans have gone out the window for a building, and it's basically everything's on hold, possibly for as long as a couple months,
mm-hmm.
because everything is moving so fast for the actual ERDF events.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really cool.
Yeah.
Right? That's kind of the point of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm feeling really good about it.
So last weekend,
yeah.
we had our first meet and greet for ERDF. Didn't
yeah.
know what to expect.
Our first demo.
Demo day.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, we had a bit of a problem. We forgot about the car wash, the annual car wash, Booster Club car wash. And so we actually had to move it, the location, from in front of the school where we said we'd meet people
yeah.
to over in front of a school very
oh.
close by.
Did you find out at all if some people missed us? Because
not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet. No
yeah.
one said it directly to me.
Okay.
So several people have told me that they couldn't come, but
I'd rather they couldn't
would,
come than
yeah.
they
oh,
would
me
miss
too.
Us.
Me too. So we ended up having three families come,
mm-hmm. yep.
and all of them were very excited. It made me really want more receivers, but I'm not going to buy more receivers. We're going to make sure that we build up over time. Yeah, we're going to build up over time. So the parents and the students went out, all of them, to look for the transmitters.
Everybody was out there.
And so that was very exciting to see, because I thought the parents might come, stand back, and be like, okay, go for it. We'll
yeah.
watch from back here.
No.
And
we had to hold them back, if
yeah.
anything.
Yeah, and there were several that were very invested. And it was so funny, because the one parent who was not into walking in the woods, her daughter was so excited.
I know.
And she was not going to be left behind. She was like,
yeah,
wait, I'm
yeah.
going, I'm doing this because this is what she wants. And I thought it was such a positive attitude.
Yeah. And what you know? Amazed me, I mean, we had basically, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 people out.
Mm-hmm.
So if anybody else had showed up, we would have had to take receivers away
from the parents. I know.
So in a way, it's maybe it's better that we didn't have more people show up. We had one receiver break.
Yeah, we did.
And then we had the one that's kind of on the edge because
yeah.
of the button and the knob being forced. So we're pretty much at the edge.
Of
it's a good thing we bought a bunch more.
Yeah. And this weekend, or this Thursday, we're going to have a little event for
well, we're
gonna
see.
The makerspace. It might be just totally canceled, and that's okay with the
yeah.
rain and that.
I mean, I hope not.
Yeah.
I'm just...
I hope not too, but I also want to be open to it.
Yeah.
So we're expecting thunderstorms. That's why I said it might be canceled.
Yeah. I mean,
however,
our Saturday events, that's our rain or shine.
Yeah.
But it's kind of difficult for school events that are in the school.
Mm-hmm.
To say, well, you've got to be ready to go outside. I mean, kids just don't
right.
prepare, and you just can't ask them to.
Mm-hmm. So on Saturday, we will have another event where we have three people officially signed up, and we think that there's going to be more because of our interest on Saturday, but they just haven't signed up yet.
So we have three people signed up.
Officially.
Two of them as a team.
Yeah.
But we do have one person that said they're definitely
yeah.
signed
so,
up in quotes.
Yeah.
And by word. And then we didn't take down any information for anybody. This is just, we're so
ridiculous.
Stupid.
Yeah.
But I mean,
so
here's the thing.
All
what?
The parents that were there made sure they knew exactly where it was for
yeah.
this weekend. I'm
yeah.
like, oh no.
But so here's why this happened, right? We showed up and we made an extra effort to make, we thought no one was going to show.
Right,
right,
we did.
And possibly just one person,
mm-hmm.
the one that had already signed up. And they didn't show up,
mm-hmm.
which is not surprising because
mm-hmm.
people are busy. You know, a lot of people have said they were busy.
Yeah.
But we decided, mostly from you pushing,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was basically going to wait to see who showed up. And you were
mm-hmm.
like, no, let's put everything up. So we got there really early.
Right.
And then we had the car wash, so we moved everything. Yeah. Finally, we put up 3 transit meters.
We just got everything out right before people arrived.
And people start showing up, like, right away. So we've been out there for, like, almost 2 hours. And I'm like, fine, it'll have been for nothing, but at least we got, you know, started to put, got a bit of practice setting up the stuff, although we're getting pretty fast at it. And then they start showing up. And I'm like, okay, well, that's good. Got a couple people show up, talk to them about how it works and everything. They go out there for 10, 15 minutes and then drive away, and we can take the stuff down. 2 hours later, we haven't stopped running around.
Right, right.
And all of the parents and kids are still out.
Yeah.
They're going around, testing out the equipment. I'm seeing some of them, they're finding the controls, like where the transmitters are, and they're backing off, listening to it from different sides, going different distances away. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. So we ended up finally with 4 out.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. And then it's 2 hours into it, and I'm like, I think I need to put another one out. And you put your foot down. And no, that is enough.
Well, okay. So I was starting to see some sag. And I was like, always want them to leave in a, we found them all.
Yeah, let's move.
And so I wanted it to be something that they left feeling like, yeah, it would have been fun to have one more, but we got them all. Let's go.
So when you told me what you saw, I was just amazed, because that happened when I had been busy setting up more transmitters for them, right? So I hadn't been able to talk to people as much for a good 20 to 25 minutes. And during both the Avatar Club and the Enrichment Club, which are in-school events, the kids were so excited. And the big question was, is that going to translate into enough excitement at home that they would, you know, get their parents to drive them over on a Saturday? And we thought, maybe not, and maybe we'll get no one. So we were ready to be disappointed and be like, well, you know, if we're disappointed that way, let's not be too disappointed, you know, psychologically, because we don't know how that's going to translate. And when you mentioned what you were seeing, it's the kids that were getting tired and the parents that just were keeping going. It's like, oh my gosh, we've created monsters.
It was definitely fun.
So, but it was really rewarding to see both kids and parents both excited for this.
Yeah.
So.
And then, you know, we're hearing it from all ways. Yeah. And then looking up at overhead and seeing the wire. And I'm like, oh, sorry, forgot to tell you, move away from the wire and see what you find. And then they would hear it in different ways.
I like that we cut it back to 90-minute time limit on the course. Because if the kids are at that age, getting a bit tired when it gets to 2 hours, like, you know, that's getting to be enough. Then to give them only 90 minutes on the course seems like it's, maybe we should keep it that way.
Right, right.
We could do it slightly different for the different groups also. You know, if we get high schoolers and they start to be pretty good and they're wanting to find all five.
More perseverance, yeah.
Then we could be like, okay, you got to find 5 and you get 2 hours. Or. I mean, the full events for a classic 80 meter is, it's only 2.5 hours.
Right.
So we're getting pretty close already if we bring it to 2 hours.
I think it's a good amount of time. And
well, 90 minutes, I think, for now, until next year at least. So
we'll have a good week, very busy.
It's super busy, but very exciting.
Yes.
Got our new starter box.
Yeah.
So it beeps.
Yeah. Looks very retro.
Looks
love it.
Really retro, yeah. Didn't mean to do that. Yeah, see, that's the thing is,
it looks like he tried.
I even wrote in my blog, all building has stopped, but actually it hasn't, because I've been trying to repair stuff that's breaking.
He also made an octopus of a recharger.
the outdoor, that was getting pretty scary. We're using these transmitters and not charging them back up.
So hopefully they'll be charged today. Yeah.
Well, we hooked them up for the first time last night. You helped with soldering up the...
What were
you doing? You drilled. That's right. You were drilling while I was soldering.
I was on the drill press.
So...
Yeah.
And the voltages seemed high, but they were going up, so...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess... And all the batteries felt cool to the touch.
Yeah, which is good.
So, let me see. They're 16 AA nickel metal hydride, just to add a bit of tech here. And we're using 200 ohm resistors with a I think it's an HP power supply for an HP printer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 31 volts, I think. And we actually measured for one of them.
Right.
The current. Before we created the box, and we're getting about 60 milliamps, which is way less than the capacity divided by 10.
Yeah.
Which they say is safe for trickle.
Mm-hmm.
No. So.
Anyway, so.
I wish I would have had more time to test things out, like we did a bit of testing, but just, that's it. We need them charged for Thursday, and we're going to need them charged again for Saturday.
Yeah.
The amount of work also on the announcements
and
the website to let people know. That webpage.
And we have to send out another letter this
An
week.
Email.
An
yeah.
email this week to the Peach Jar. So.
When do you need it that by? Because that should go out as
Probably
soon as possible.
Tomorrow night we'll set it.
Tomorrow
Wednesday
night?
It can
okay.
be sent. Yep.
Because I'm... Tonight I'm getting a bit burnt out.
No, tonight's done, but we'll set it up tomorrow. But very good news, and nice to see people excited and getting into it. Busy week this week.
Busy week. You know, you were saying about the receivers. Well, you know, we'll have to fix what we have and just do what we have, but... I think a lot of people are going to buy them.
Yeah, I hope so.
And that means that without even spending any money, we'll have more available for others because they won't need to use the rentals.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be handy.
No, I'm really hoping that's what happens. Okay, so I think it is that time.
I think it's that time.
Okay.
To call it. Wait, you started the album last time. Okay, I'm here. Thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.